We'll call the meeting to order. Representative Gazelka will move the minutes from the last meeting. And all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Welcome to the Tourism Committee. And we also have some visitors here, and we're going to real quickly introduce the students from Fergus Falls. You might want to stand up and we can give you a little applause. And it appears like everyone is willing to preserve our heritage and our resorts in Minnesota. Sounds great.
It's nice to know, in case we have a severe water sprinkler malfunction, that everybody here will be taken care of.
Hopefully. Okay, well, we're going to start out. Joel, would you like to start out? Okay, you might want to sit at the microphone, though, and identify yourself for the committee, although we all know you, but the rest of the folks might not.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson, and I have a legal research and government affairs business, and I've had since 1997 the pleasure of representing a hard-working group of our citizenry called the Congress of Minnesota Resorts. And, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to at least let the group know that it's not just an ordinary group of students from the Fergus Falls High School. They are with the Close Up Washington program, and they're here studying our government in preparation for a trip to Washington, D.C. to spend a week there with our leaders in Washington. And I just think their commitment to what everyone does in government and how it impacts all of us is just such a pleasure to see, and thank them for being here. And being from a resort area, they, I think, understand, and we pitched them a little bit on how important it is that we retain our resort heritage. Mr. Chairman, thank you for giving the Congress this opportunity to talk with you about a number of issues that impact the small resort and tourism business. We've laid out an agenda for you and probably just ready to roll right with that. But we're here not to ask you to save the resorting industry. We're here to ask you to preserve part of our heritage in this state. It's a vital part of our state, and we're asking you to preserve it and take steps to preserve this important asset that we have in this state, so that we don't become the land of 10,000 lake accesses, that we remain the land of 10,000 lakes, and that our citizens have the opportunity to utilize the great natural resources that we have. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to call on Jennifer Bateman, one of the officers of the Congress, and from there you can just flow through the agenda, and I think everyone's ready to testify as you call them, and they've tried to limit their remarks between 5 and 10 minutes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Ms. Bateman, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Jennifer Bateman. My husband Bob and I own Two Inlets Resort, which is in Park Rapids, Minnesota. We also have three small children, Grace, Calvin, and Jack, and that's how we make our livelihood, is at the resort. We've been there for 8 summers. We're going on summer number 9, and we plan to do it for probably at least another 20 years. It's a family-run business. It's just the 5 of us that do it with a few extra employees. We have 13 housekeeping cabins that are located on a lake, but some resorts are on other types of waterfront as well. And I believe that the profile of my resort, though all resorts are a little bit different, profile of my resort is probably pretty average of most resorts in the state of Minnesota. The Congress of Minnesota Resorts, we've got about 40 of us over here, has a membership of right around 200 resorts. There are roughly 980 resorts in the state of Minnesota. Back in the early 70s, there were as many as 4,000 resorts, and as you probably know, those numbers have been declining rapidly as the value of lakeshore is steadily increasing. The motto of the Congress of Minnesota Resorts is Resorters Helping Resorters. One of our main goals is to preserve the family-owned and operated resort within the state of Minnesota. We do a fair amount of educating resort owners throughout the year on a regular basis, because we want resort owners to be educated so that they can own and operate a quality property and have a quality experience for people that are wanting to take a vacation on the lake. You received a packet that's got a brief review of what our issues are. Please be sure to read that, review it at your leisure, but we hope that you'll take the time to look that over. And just like Joel said, we're not asking you to save us. What we're asking is that you do what you can legislatively to help preserve Minnesota resorts, which are a very unique and a very important aspect of the whole tourism industry in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't see anyone raising their hand for questions. Maybe we can hold the questions till later anyway. Is Mr. Edmund here?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is John Edmund, Director of Explore Minnesota. Tourism. I've appeared before you in the past, and we talked very generally about Minnesota tourism, Explore Minnesota Tourism as the organization, and the importance of this industry to the state of Minnesota. What I wanted to do here today is to talk very specifically about the importance of resorts to Minnesota tourism. It was mentioned that there's approximately 1,000 resorts in Minnesota. This is substantially down from years past. But the recent information that we have available, this generates over $10.9 million in taxes to the state of Minnesota. Thousands of people that go to resorts every year also spend money that boasts local tourism businesses, such as restaurants, shops, and service stations. It's an integral part of our $9 billion industries. Most resorts in Minnesota are family-owned businesses operated in rural areas, providing jobs for entrepreneurs and for others in their communities. Resorts play a significant role in rural economies, contributing to jobs, contributing to sales, tax base, and quality of life. And through various private investments, resorts provide with public access to Minnesota's vast natural resources. And that's extremely important as we consider the numbers of resorts that are declining in the state of Minnesota and the access we have for normal citizens to come up and enjoy the lakes throughout Minnesota. It's an important part of our tourism product also in Minnesota. Resort experience is really what differentiates Minnesota from the rest of the country and helps define us as a tourism destination. Resorts in most other destinations are very large establishments, but in Minnesota, that size is very much smaller, with resorts having 10 or fewer lakeside cabins. And the intimate character of these resorts is a very significant lure for travelers to our state. It's really a classic. Minnesota resorts are a classic dating back over 100 years, and it's one of our state's most important tourism products in attracting residents and non-residents and alike. And they've become often a long-standing family tradition. The other important thing I want to mention about resorts is its contributions to quality of life. Resorts offer people experiences that they wouldn't otherwise have a chance to enjoy. A lot of people aren't able to own their own lakeside cabin. Resorts offer guests a chance to relax, refresh, spend time with family and friends, whether it's family reunions, gatherings, corporate retreats. These are often things that take place on Minnesota resorts. And resorts are also good neighbors. Let's not forget that they offer local residents with services such as convenience stores, restaurants, and they also, many resorts, many people here that are not only spending their time to be with you today, but they volunteer in a variety of community organizations and essential services throughout Minnesota. And the other thing, I guess the last point I wanted to mention is they are linked to Minnesota outdoors. They're stewards of the environment. People that run resorts, they care about the environmental quality of our lakes, and they enjoy that experience and sharing it with people from all throughout the country. Outdoor recreation is one of the reasons that people travel to Minnesota, and resorts provide guests with opportunities and access to things like fishing, hunting, skiing, snowmobiling, hiking, biking, and wildlife watching. Most resorts are located on a lake, providing access to lakefront activities, and unlike a public access, they allow their guests to experience the lakefront as well as the lake. So I hope you very carefully listen to some of the things that this group is going to bring to you today. It's an important part of our industry. And one of the issues that I think that probably will be brought up by some of the other speakers is the issues regarding lakeshore management, some zoning issues. There are some issues all throughout the state and various counties. There are moratoriums trying to balance the issues, the demands of the homeowners as well as the resorts. We're looking for solutions on that in order to preserve resorts for Minnesota. One of the things that we're doing with Explore Minnesota Tourism is we're working with the Initiative Foundation to hold a conference on March 1st where we're going to try to bring together various sides, whether they be the resorts, the business owners, the homeowners, the county administrators, to find common ground and how we can work together to preserve this important resource in our state. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Edman. Representative Moll?
Mr. Edman, I think you might want to wait. Mr. Edman, just a quick question for you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know we're going to have some speakers that are going to give us some direction on this, but Tourism Explore Minnesota has been pretty active already in looking at this resort issue and how to keep more and more of these open. In a nutshell, do you have some directional thoughts on this for us? I mean, based on your experience so far, a lot of us have a vested interest in obviously making it easier for the resorts to stay open. If you had, if you could point your finger any one or two directions.
Mr. Edmund.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Moll, the issues that you're going to hear about with resorts are very complex, and there's many levels to it. There's issues relative to zoning. There's issues relative to taxing. There's issues relative to fire marshal fees. There's a number of different issues that are very critical to this resort industry. But as I sit back and I look at the issues of shoreline management and the balancing of the needs of resorts, businesses, and homeowners, I think we have to find a common ground. I think that we often miss that common ground, and that is the quality of the resources of Minnesota and the lakes. No one is out to hurt the quality of those lakes. The resorts care about it as much as the people that own the homes. And so we have to find that common ground to allow the resorts, the businesses to thrive, as well as the homeowners that have cabins on the lake to also enjoy that resource in a compatible way. And I think that's the one thing we often miss when we're dealing with this balancing of needs between resorts, environmentalists, and others. We all have the same thing in common. We just need to get to that common ground.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Edmund. Mr. Novotny. Might add from Hackensack, Minnesota. How many lakes in a 110-mile radius?
Within a 10-mile radius, we have 127.
Good. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Mark Novotny. I own the Hideaway Bay Resort on beautiful Birch Lake in Hackensack. We have, my wife and I run and operate the resort, and we have 16 cabins. I'm here also representing the Cass County Tourism Preservation Task Force. And the we're dealing with zoning ordinances. And the biggest thing that we've had to come up with is a definition of a resort so that we can redefine resorts as zoning, so that we're as a separate zoning entity. The we also, in this zoning, we want to replace structures that are in their existing locations. Because when people come up to the resorts, they want where that cabin set for 50 or 100 years. They don't want it to move back 200 feet. Okay. The other thing that we're dealing with is increased density for building footprint percentages. And if you get into zoning, we have to deal with that as well. We're also asking, as far as Cass County is concerned, to be a permitted use rather than conditional use. That way we can, if we need to make a change quickly in the resort because of a fire or a storm, we can do that quickly. With conditional use, it takes a longer period of time to do that. Some of the other things that we're concerned about is once we start changing those structures, we also want to make sure that our sewage treatments are up to date. And that's an environmental issue. Another thing that we are proposing to Cass County is to have at least 50% of our shoreline in its natural state. So whether we have that now or in the future, we want to bring these lakes back to a natural state. So if we've torn them up or whatever, we're trying to get that back. And then, of course, the other issue is if the resort sells, then it would be a conversion issue. It may be sent back into a resort. The buyer may want to keep it as a resort, which is great. But if it does convert over into something else, then the issue would be that those buildings have to be meet the standard setbacks of something other than a resort. Okay, so they may have to move the buildings. The Cass County Tourism Task Force has been meeting for the last year, and we've come up with a definition, and I'll just quickly read it to you. It says, a resort is any tourism facility licensed by the Minnesota Department of Health and subject to inspection by appropriate state and local agencies that provide multiple rooms, cabins, campsites, and or mobile home sites for rent to the general public on a transient basis for the primary purpose of providing access to Minnesota's natural resources, including but not limited to Minnesota's lakes, rivers, forested areas, and trail systems. As required by law, the facility collects and pays Minnesota sales tax and other appropriate local taxes. Primary purpose is defined for this purpose shall mean that the facility receives 75% of its rental income from patrons using the facility for access to Minnesota's natural resources. The maximum occupancy for any resort unit provided and or maintained by the facility shall be determined by dividing the total square footage of the units, less bathrooms, by 60 and the minimum square footage per person required by Minnesota Department of Health. The reason that last part was put in is because we do have a lot of older cabins that are smaller in size, and if something should happen to those cabins, the way the Minnesota Department of Health reads is that we have to have 60 square feet per person per bedroom. So an average bedroom size for two people occupancy is 120 square feet. I just built a cabin 28 by 40, and two-thirds of that cabin is bedroom. So it limits my living space because of that. I want to thank the Tourism Committee for listening, and I believe I'm on to the next one. Do you have any questions?
Representative Moore.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. A couple quick questions for you. What's the deal with bedrooms? Why do they need to be so big? That's the first one. I'm sure there's a rationale for that. And the second question is in regards to the shoreline ordinance that we just addressed for a minute. You suggested that you'd like to see, from your task force, that you'd like to see 50% of the shoreline restored to a natural state. Explain how that would actually make it easier for resorts, or how that fits into making the permitting process easier for resorts.
Okay, Mr. Navani.
Your question on bedroom size. Because resorts are not defined in the Minnesota Department of Health, we fall under hotel motels. So they require 60% or 60 square feet per person in a unit. Now, the department defines it as a room, and so that falls into our category, saying that we have to have 60 square feet per room for sleeping area. And the proposal we're trying to get through is that we define it as a unit and not bedroom. That's that. The 50% lakeshore, that is an environmental thing. We're stewards of the land for the lakes. And so as an environmental issue, we would like to give back or at least maintain at least 50% of that lakeshore for habitat, for, well, fish, birds, whatever. It helps to keep the natural resource intact. Does that answer your question?
Representative
Chairman, My understanding, though, and I've heard this from other resorters, a friend of mine, a cabin burned down at Coles Resort, Ron Mason. It took him forever to get the permits necessary to build this cabin back in the same spot. And so I've heard again and again that the permitting actually to develop or rebuild anything along the shoreline can be just really terrible for resort owners. How would that fit into reestablishing 50% of the shoreline into natural state? Wouldn't that make that more complicated? Do you see what I'm getting at here?
Our environmental services people, it's not a complicated issue because if that shoreline was sand, it stays sand.
Right.
Okay? If that shoreline was changed over from sand and it was riprap or natural vegetation at one time, then all we're saying is that 50% of it has to be returned back to the natural state.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Devani.
Thank you.
Mr. Becker. Thanks for coming, guys.
Always go to my table.
Yeah.
Cool.
Mr. Becker, just state your name for the record, then go ahead and proceed.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. My name is Ed Becker, and my wife and I own Inwego Resort up in the Nevis, Minnesota area. I am going to be covering some information up to date. We've been talking a little bit about the importance of tourism and the impact it has on the state, and some a few of the shoreline regulations that Cass County Task Force has been addressing. I'm going to try to go over a report that was done by Witsis, Smith, and Nolting, and it's a engineering firm, an architectural consultant, that put together some numbers for the Bemidji area to try to bring the impact to real numbers and what it means to a geographical region. Joel, what was this in their packet? Okay. In your packet, you'll find handouts. It says resort fact sheet on it. And what I'm going to do is kind of walk through that real brief. They did a study, and this report was prepared by Paul Richards, who's a member of the Bemidji Area Chamber of Commerce. And also a member of the Public Affairs Committee within that. And some of you may know him. this study was conducted to quantify and identify the impact of tourism in that region. Within a 20-mile radius of Bemidji, there were 34 resorts they came up with a total cabins of 409 and 123 campsites. Then we're going to move out to a little further out. We're going to move into that 21 to 40-mile radius of Bemidji, and you wind up with 375 units and 263 campsites. We're going to jump here to the next page, and we move into the next category was 41 to 60-mile radius of Bemidji, and there was a total of 78 resorts that fell within that category, and a total of 881 rental units. And 223 campsites. Then we move into the last category, which is 61 to 120 miles north of Bemidji. You got a total cabins of 36 units and 20 campsites. Please jump ahead two pages, and we're going to go over the summary real brief, what all of those rental units mean to that region. We had a total cabin rental units. If you add all them up, you'll have 1,701 units and 629 campsites. if you jump down about the middle of the page, where it starts talking about guest expenditures, expenditures per cabin. Now, keep in mind that's per cabin. We've got 1,700 cabins. Take 1,700 cabins times 21,000. And that was a figure that was done by the University of Minnesota, I believe. And that was done in 2000. So the number you see right underneath that is an inflated number for approximately what it would mean in 2005. That number expands out to $26,000 per rental cabin unit. And you start breaking that down, it equivalates up to $44 million and some change per year. That's lodging sales. There is also another figure out there done by the University of Minnesota, and that study indicates that for each one of those dollars, there's an additional $2.29 spent locally outside of the resort generally. That's the local grocery store.
Mr. Becker?
Yes.
Just while it's on my mind, will you get this information for us later? If it's $21,000 per cabin per season, what are you calling the season?
Between 10 and 13 weeks is generally the typical season.
Do you know the time frames that they picked to do this study? Or if you don't know it now, you can...
Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't know that exact number, but it will probably typically run between Memorial Day and Labor Day.
Mr. Becker, where I'm going with this is what I would like us to determine. You, Representative Moe already knows where I'm going with this. I want to determine what a four-day weekend, the second largest vacation weekend in the summer in Minnesota, what resorts can earn or lose over that weekend, and then relate that to not only sales tax, but gas tax, lodging taxes, and food, groceries, you know, everything that is spent over that Labor Day weekend. So maybe you can talk to some folks.
Yeah.
If you're thinking.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'll have to get that number for you. I don't have it right now.
We'd greatly appreciate it. And then go ahead. Sorry for the interruption, but go ahead and continue.
Using the $2.29 multiplier, it equivalates to about $185 million in gross sales, lodging sales, which generates, Mr. Edmund referred to earlier, $10.9 million in sales tax. That pretty much concludes mainly what I wanted to cover here today. I appreciate you for your time, Mr. Chair and board members.
One second. Representative Simpson.
Yes, Mr. Becker, just this is a hypothetical question for you. There's a proposal by the city of Bemidji to put on a half a percent local sales tax. Could you tell me if you feel that would be beneficial to the resort industry in your area, or would it be a detriment?
I'm sorry, did you say half a percent local surcharge?
Local option sales tax for
okay.
The city of Bemidji.
Sure. I can tell you that those dollars are generally used to help fund a lot of the advertising initiatives locally to that area. The impact, of course, is it's got to be positive, because a lot of times those dollars are used exclusively for advertising for that area, and it's going to give them a lot of money to work with.
Representative Simpson, I know where you're going with this.
Representative Simpson, I think he missed your question. And Mr. Chairman, it's okay. You're talking about the lodging tax.
Yes.
Yeah, and. Which goes to advertising for the Bemidji area. What Representative Simpson is talking about is a sales tax that would be assessed on everything that sales tax could be assessed on in the state or in the city of Bemidji should that pass. So on food, clothing, gas, whatever else. How would you think that might affect your business?
Mr. Becker.
I'm sorry, I am not real familiar with the half a percent sales tax issue. I live in the 40-mile range away from Bemidji, so I'm a little removed from that. However, I would guess that would not impact business at all as far as people being deterred from buying things. I don't believe that would hinder that at all.
Thank you. Mr. Becker, maybe we're still not clear, but... The guests that would be at your resort, if they go shopping and they would have to spend half a percent more in sales tax in Bemidji, they might go shopping in Nevis or somewhere else, or Park Rapids or
sure.
Somewhere else.
Okay.
Or Walker.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Becker.
Okay.
Appreciate it. The Kellers, are they here?
Mr. Chairman, board members, my name is Mary Jane Keller. My husband Dave and I own Brookside Resort in Park Rapids, Minnesota, on beautiful Two Inlets Lake. We've been there, this is coming on our 28th year.
Wow.
So we've been in the resort business a very long time and have had the pleasure of experiencing the tradition that's so ingrained in our state. We, as I said, we have 28 cabins. We are a family recreation resort. It's very ironic that one of the students here from Fergus Falls, actually, she and her family vacation at our resort and have for, I think, the last 15 years. So once the tradition is there, it continues. And you may have that, you may know of that kind of thing yourself. The one issue that we wanted to address was the post-Labor Day school start. In the 28 years that we have been here, we have watched that idea come up time and time again. When we originally came in 1978, you had a solid season from Memorial Day until Labor Day. School didn't start until after Labor Day, and our 28 cabins were booked solid through that. We've watched that change, especially in the last 5 years. Now, schools are starting earlier. The sports schedule is starting earlier. The window of time for everyone to vacation is getting smaller and smaller. Our season used to be 14 weeks long. Now, in some cases, I hear resorters talking about a 10-week season or an 8-week season, and that's just not enough time. Our summers are precious here in Minnesota. They are short enough. The idea of letting them go from Memorial Day to Labor Day is very, very important. Not only with us and our business, but also with the staff that we hire. We employ 10 full-time staff and then extra 16 extra staff members on just Saturdays. That's income oftentimes used for higher education. You know, their college kids or whatever that are going on. So to lengthen the season to go on through Labor Day makes a big, big difference.
She leaves little to say. I come at this issue especially with kind of a unique perspective in that I have been resorting for 28 years. I also spent 10 years on the school board along with Representative Saylor's husband for a few of those years. And I was also on Governor Pawlenty's Educational Standards Committee as I chaired the high school MAP subcommittee. So I've got a big interest in both education and in tourism. And I know you're hearing people say we can't fit in a school year if we start it after Labor Day. And, you know, I had 10 years of working on those schedules for the school. And it can be done. It's a matter of choices. But the bottom line is that families in Minnesota much prefer a consistent day to start, and that would be the day after Labor Day. There's no questions about that. They know when school starts, and they prefer that. You may think that families with young children prefer to get them into school. It's easier from a family standpoint if they have jobs. If they start earlier, they have more breaks, and that's harder to arrange for them, too. But the bottom line for us, business-wise, is it's a huge impact for us. On years when schools start before Labor Day, our business can be anywhere from half to two-thirds what it normally would be. And that time of year in a normal summer, just our resort, we will take in $30,000 to $40,000. So it's cut accordingly. And as the figures were already put on the table, that means another $2.29 for each of those dollars that's spent locally. That adds up in a hurry as those tourists aren't there. And it's very difficult on our business. I can't tell you how excited I am that there is this tourism committee. This is a wonderful thing for us. We're so excited to have you here. This is a big issue for us, and we hope that you will. Those of you that aren't quite on board yet will have an open mind about this and listen to people in the state, not just the resort owners, but the citizens of the state. I truly believe this is what they want, and that's what we're here for, is to make life best in Minnesota. Thank you for everything you do to help preserve this tradition.
Representative Saylor.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Keller, We didn't really hear a lot about the employment. You spoke briefly about it. I'm just kind of curious as to what sort of an impact, what's your employment profile on the community? What kind of a difference does a resort such as yours, or maybe you can speak for some of the other resort owners as well, in terms of employment within the community, what kind of an impact does it make?
Mr. Chair, Representative Saylor, we ourselves employ 10 full-time employees plus another 15 to 18 part-time people that come in just to do our cleaning. Those are people that are not needed or not there if we don't have the business or they have to go back to school. Besides that, we employ the local laundry service. We employ the people that deliver supplies to us, the bait dealer, everybody else in town doing those jobs. So when you consider really how many people work for us through that kind of contracting and directly, it's quite a loss of employment funds if we don't have the business there.
The impact on our town when the 15th of August hits is marked. I mean, it's like the business drops off. The streets are deserted. And that's because people have gone back to school. They're getting ready for that.
Representative Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Keller, you talked about $30,000 or so on that weekend. What is it when they're back in school? How much does that drop off?
Well, as I, Mr. Chairman, as I said, it can be anywhere from half that amount to two-thirds, depending on which day of the week that those schools are going to start.
So if you take 15 or 20,000 times the number of resorts that we have, that's
can
huge.
Be significant.
Another question. Mr. Keller, I have to bring this question up. It surfaces throughout the rest of this body on occasion, but I'm curious from all of you, and if you don't want to answer this question today, you could give that information to the committee staff later, but what's the average going wage of people that work at resorts? Is it over 6.5, under 6.5? Give me a ballpark.
Well, it's well over 6.5, Mr. Chairman. It's well over 6.5 at our resort. We expect to hire the best people, and this year we'll be paying for our full-time staff $9.25 per hour.
So
our kids do very well.
Mr. Keller, for the benefit of this chairman who's from northern Minnesota, so we're a little slow sometimes, passing a law raising minimum wage to $6.50 isn't going to create more wealth for your employees?
Mr. Chair, no. Our cleaning staff earns over $13 an hour, and our full-time, as I said, are over $9 an hour.
Thank you very much. Representative Moll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A quick follow-up question to Representative Gazelka's. I've heard figures something like 12 to 1 for dollars that actually are spent at a resort, and then how many dollars are spent in the community. Do you have a figure that you use, or maybe even there's somebody in the gallery that could use a general figure that you use? I'm thinking about, again, you know, we're losing a few days here, probably the busiest days of the season. How much additional money could that potentially cost our communities?
Mr. Chair, the figures that I have on that from a study done in Becker County is for, and actually the same figure that we received from Mr. Edmond and a flyer from the Office of Tourism, is that for every dollar spent at the resort, another $2.29 is spent within the community on other vacation items.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Hammer, we've been waiting to hear from you. And Senator, you're more than welcome to come and sit with us.
Oh, but I'm having so much fun with my ornaments.
Okay.
He's trying to blend in.
Right, yeah. Mr. Hammer, please identify yourself for the tape and then proceed.
Good afternoon. Thanks for the invitation to be here today. Today, I think, Ich bin ein Resorter. We have a spare life jacket. No, we're... my name's Jerry Hammer. I've worked at the State Fair since I was 15. I'm 50 now. This is my 36th year at the fair. I've been the general manager. This is my 9th year in that capacity. I need to say right off the bat, the fair, when we talk about post-Labor Day school opening, the fair is not saying that the State Fair is more important than education. and kids. That's not the case at all. In fact, that's the very core of our mission. Education is what the fair is all about. That's what we do. We connect people to their communities. We connect them to their government. We connect them to each other. A trip to the fair is like 100 field trips rolled into one, as far as educational value is concerned. So that's where we come from. There are some quantifiable issues that do come up when school opens prior to Labor Day, and in a year where we have good weather throughout, then people will try to come on other days. Attendance will be down. 4-H FFA opportunities are certainly down. In a year like we had this year, where we also had bad weather second week, and then it really hurt us. But here's the quantifiable measures that we have when school opens prior to Labor Day. Over the 3 days this year where school was in session, our overall attendance was off 58,000 people from the average attendance for those same number of days. There's a lot of families in there. And with time becoming more and more precious with families, I had a couple of friends of mine that they had planned on, because school opened, to bring their kids on the second weekend. Second weekend washed out, so they didn't get a chance to go to the fair this year. And that happened with a good number of people. The state fair employs, in our own departments, about 4,000 people during the fair. A lot of them are high school kids in particular. And our concessionaires and commercial exhibitors will employ about 10,000 people during the course of the fair. When school opens early, a lot of those hours are lost. That employment opportunity is also lost. Our youth programs, one of the biggest things we do at the fair when it comes to agriculture, which is a real bedrock, are our youth programs. That's 4-H and FFA in particular. And when school opens early, then FFA and 4-H winds up being truncated. Trips are cut off, or they don't happen at all. There were actually 3 days during the fair this year where the 4-H building was closed, which is unheard of. But it was necessary this year because there weren't enough kids. There weren't any kids to come to the fair. One of the state fair board members lives up in Shevlin, and his son won a 4-H trip at the county fair level. And they spent more time on the bus going back and forth. They were just at the fair for part of the day. Spent more time on the bus, actually, than at the fair. Then there's an economic impact as well. In the Twin Cities alone, the fair has an economic impact of about $150 million annually. When fair attendance suffers, when our youth programs are truncated, when there's not as much business for vendors, then that overall economic impact suffers as well. That's it in a nutshell.
Thank you.
Our perspective.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hammer, you talked a little bit about 4-H drop-off, and some of the members of the committee know myself and my wife both judge 4-H. We saw many kids who didn't make the trip down from Bemidji to the state fair this year. Do you have a sense of how many kids we're talking about that either didn't make it down to the state fair or for 4-H, or only came down for a short period when they usually come down for a longer period of time to participate in 4-H?
Mr. Hammer.
I can't tell you exactly what the number is. I do know that it was substantial. I know that 4-H right now, Brad Rugg is our 4-H superintendent of all the 4-H related programs is a fair, and he's compiling some data right now. I do know that the number of kids that were affected was substantial. It was the majority of kids that either had a trip cut short or that weren't able to go at all.
Mr. Chairman, would you be willing to get that information to us as soon as you get it? I think that would be important for our case. Yep. Thank you.
Yes.
Mr. Hammer, I've been led to believe that the 4-H'ers at some point are going to support you and support the issue of after Labor Day school start. Have you heard anything about that? Have you been in contact with them? Or?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, as recently as yesterday afternoon, our 4-H superintendent, I've talked to him a number of times, and he says, yeah, absolutely, he supports the initiative. He right now has passed a resolution that was adopted by the State Fair's governing body onto University Council for review. precisely what they'll be able to do within the university communities up in the air right now, but at the very least, he said he personally would get involved, as will 4-H group leaders from around the state.
Mr. Hammer, I'm going to go out on a limb here. When you've talked about this with other people, or if you've tried to get people to listen to you and take your side of the issue, or get support, I know getting the 4-H club would probably be easy, but have you ever approached the AFL-CIO, the labor industry? Since it's Labor Day, wouldn't you think that they might be supportive of this?
Mr. Chair, we sent out late last week about 10,000 pieces of mail to people that are involved in the fair one way or another. That group includes all of the State Agricultural Society delegates. They represent every county in the state, 87 county fairs around the state. To commercial exhibitors at the fair, and the AFL-CIO is a big participant, so they're well aware of what we're doing, and hopefully every legislator will hear about the initiative in some form from somebody involved with the fair.
Well, Mr. Hammer, it's great that the St. Paul schools wait till after Labor Day to start. That's very kind of them. Of course, they don't have any place to park, but that's all right, too. But we're very appreciative of the St. Paul School Districts. Representative Saylor.
Mr. Chair, and I have just one question. This may not be the right question for you, but I'll ask it anyway. Regarding less participation at the state fair on the part of 4-H'ers, do you have any idea or any figures of how much of that would be potentially due to the Labor Day, the changes, on how much to cutbacks to extension in the 4-H program?
Mr. Hammer.
At this point, the cutbacks to the 4-H program will have an effect, but at this point they haven't because they're still relatively new. The 4-H is largely volunteer-driven, and the volunteers are still going at it, although it's getting tougher to get things done with area or district coordinators as opposed to county extension. The fall off we saw in 4-H participation this year was due exclusively to early school opening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dave Thompson. Going to talk about the State Fire Marshal's Office. Please state your name for the record and then proceed.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Dave Thompson. I own Fisherman's Village Resort in the Otter Tail County of Minnesota, and I'm here representing the Congress of Minnesota Resort's opinion on how the State Fire Marshal's Office has operated since the 2003 budget year where the fee increase or the fee system was implemented. I think since most of you may or may not know about what has happened with it, it would be fair to give you a short, brief history on how the Fire Marshal's Office was created and how we've gotten to this point. The State Fire Marshal's Office was created in 1905. At the same time, the legislature instituted a means of, with legislation, of how to fund the department. They taxed every single fire insurance policy in the state 0.5%. And that would go into a special fund, and the Fire Marshal's Office would be able to use that at their discretion in its entirety, and any funds over that, the state had no obligation to pay any salaries or fees or anything to operate the department. That tax is still being taxed on every single fire insurance policy in the state. In 1977, there was several hotel and resort fires in Minnesota that resulted in many deaths. In 1978, the legislature created an amendment that required all the lodging in Minnesota to be inspected. And all the resorts, hotels and motels and bed and breakfasts were supposed to have been inspected since 1978, and many of us have been. In 1981, the legislature had a bad budget year, and the funds from the state fire marshal insurance tax were taken and put into the general fund, and the state fire marshal's office was then funded from the state general fund. Since then, the general fund dollars given to the state fire marshal's office every time there was a budget problem has been reduced. In 2003, it was reduced by 25%, and all of the funds were taken out of the residential division, which in turn inspects the lodging. The lodging at that point, the state fire marshal's office was directed to figure out a way to fund the department, and they elected to charge a fee, which was a $435 base fee and then $5 per cabin on top of that per resort. The motels had a different setup, but basically it was about the same. It was based on the number of rooms and a base fee. In my case, I have an 8-cabin resort, and my fee was just shy of $500 every 3 years. And my fire marshal, to do an inspection, was there about 20 minutes because he's been there, you know, multiple times in my 15 years. They tell me that they can spend longer than that, but in general, they're never there more than 35 to 50 minutes at a normal size resort. Obviously, if they were at a large facility, say like Fair Hills or Cragans or some place that had multiple bedrooms and multiple buildings, they may be there somewhat longer. But in those cases, like Fair Hills Resort, as an example, their inspection fee was over $3,000. There are many motels and hotels in the state that are paying thousands of dollars in inspection fees because it's a per bedroom or per room rate. The lodging industry was the only industry that was targeted for this fee, although the residential division inspects many, many things, and up until the funding cuts, were supposed to inspect things like propane dispensing facilities, juvenile homes, prison facilities, college dormitories, things like the Concordia Language Camp. All of those things are now not being inspected. In the 2003 legislative session, we came to the legislature and explained what would happen with this fee, and both the House and the Senate voted unanimously, I believe, or almost unanimously, to give us an exemption for small resorts and small motels. Unfortunately, the tax code was used for 1C designation to include the resorts that were used to be exempt. And what that really meant was that any resort that was homesteaded or had any portion of it homesteaded became exempt, and any resort that didn't have that homestead had to pay a fee. So as an example, a large resort that the owner lived on the property and homesteaded any part of it, even if they had 500 rooms available or beds, they still were exempt from the fee. But my neighboring resort, who doesn't live there year-round, paid a fee and he has 10 cabins. So as it turns out, the fee wasn't really delivered properly, but 87% of the resorts in Minnesota were exempt and about 49% of the motels, which meant that there was about 50% funding loss to the state fire marshal's office. Last year, the session, we had discussed it with both the House and the Senate, and both legislative houses determined that it should be funded out of the general fund, but since there was no special session and the language was different, nothing happened. As a result, in the last fall of 2004, I asked for a report from the state fire marshal's office how they were doing on their inspections, how far were they behind. And I also asked them at that point to supply, as part of that report, how many facilities they had inspected that generated a fee versus how many that didn't generate a fee. At that point, it was clear from the report that they were barely inspecting any place that generated no fee and only targeting the places that had a fee. In fact, they were inspecting places that weren't due for inspection for 6 months, and they hadn't inspected places that have been due for inspection since 1996. And they were supposed to inspect them every 3 years. Then this fall, since they were so far behind, at that point they were about 600 resorts behind, 500 motels behind, and 900 daycares behind. They found language in cooperation with the Attorney General's office that said, you know, resorts really don't fit into the hotel description. in the statutes that they have been requiring us to comply to for 45 years, which meant that they quit doing inspections of resorts altogether. I asked them to then refund all the fees that they had collected for the past 2 years, since we would not have had to pay those, and obviously they refused to do that. Then there was a legislative proposal put out by the State Fire Marshal's Office in August of 2004 that they now want to add all the lodging facilities and juvenile homes into statute 499F that would now actually put the language back in there to inspect us again. And my personal belief is that all they've really done is wipe the slate clean for their backlog, and now they want to start inspecting again because they know it needs to be done. We all want to be inspected. We all want to be safe. And in my case, I know I've been required to remove underground gas tanks, put egress windows in at a great expense to the resort, and I wanted to do all those things to be safe. They cited statutes in the state code that required me to do that, and now I wouldn't have had to do that if I didn't really fall into that category of what was considered inspectable. The latest thing that's happened now is that the State Fire Marshal's Office in their pipeline safety email from Jerry Rosenthal has sent out an email, and I have a copy for each one of you if you'd like. In the governor's budget, said that the governor's proposal or plan to fund the State Fire Marshal's Office would be to remove the exemption that you gave us 2 years ago and reinstitute a fee to fund the department. Fortunately, I was able to discuss this yesterday with the governor, and he seemed somewhat surprised that that was the case. So I urge each one of you to talk to the governor and ask him how he really wants to fund this department. And I would ask you to also ask why we can't use the funds that were collected and still collected for over 100 years and now are not being used in any way, shape, or form for the State Fire Marshal's Office.
I think they've been spent. But go ahead.
And that really concludes the information that I have. But I also wanted to say that the lodging associations in Minnesota, which there are three main ones, have all worked together on a State Fire Marshal's task force for the past 3 years, and we're all unanimous agreement that, and we turned out a task force report that virtually no one read on all the different ways to fund it, and every one of those ways included in some way, shape, or form using the insurance fund.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Thompson, so let me just state the obvious here. Currently, the state of Minnesota collects funds as a surtax on insurance that was originally intended to fund inspections, correct?
Yes.
Do you know how much money, in fact, they are collecting for this purpose, and is that amount of money sufficient to do the needed inspections?
Actually, in 2004, they call it something different now, but the insurance tax, the 0.5%, was more than $6 million in the fund, and it has grown at over 18% per year since 2000. The State Fire Marshal's budget that I listened to last week when I testified in the Senate on this was, I believe, just the entire department was less than $4 million. The residential part of it was about $1.8 million, I believe. And that's with only five staff now. In 1991, they had 15 to inspect the entire state.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative.
So there's more than enough money.
There's more than enough money, and there's almost no inspectors left. They have replaced no retirements and no job changes. And like I say, their staff has dropped from 15 to 5. And those inspectors' average mileage per day of inspection is 225 miles per day of inspection driving.
One last question then. In charging an additional fee above the fee that you're already paying on your insurance, that would be taxing you twice for the same service, correct?
If you call a fee a tax, yes. It has the same amount of letters, but yes, we would be, the lodging industry would be paying an additional tax over what everyone in the state who buys a fire insurance policy would be paying. We all of our insurance policies have this tax on it, and our insurance is very high.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Thompson, we're going to, staff is going to look into that a little bit closer and talk to people on state government finance and see if we can get the hardcore numbers and get some answers from them. I think they're the committee that oversees that, and we'll work on that and we'll get back to you.
Thank you.
Mr. Carlson. Excuse me, Mr. Carlson, I had one last question for Mr. Thompson, and he doesn't have to get up. He can maybe just let me know after the meeting. But during his testimony, he mentioned how some of the fire inspections were lacking, and I thought Representative Moe caught this, but you might have missed it. You mentioned Concordia Language Village has not been inspected in several years. If you could check into that and find out and get back to Representative Moe and myself to make sure that those kids are protected and that facility is inspected.
I think Mr. Gray, you'd appreciate that information too.
I think you would. Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I just wanted to wrap up with a couple of tax-related issues that we've brought to a number of you in the past, and maybe get some of those issues on the table. Before I do that, though, number one, would like to thank the committee for the time you've given to the Congress of Resorts and to the issues of resort preservation. I want you to know also that it isn't just the resort industry, and would like to acknowledge and recognize the help that we get from Hospitality Minnesota and the State Fair, Tony Quillis and Tom Day, Sarah Pisick and Joe Bagnoli have left the room. Lucy Bocic was here. We are trying to build a coalition on this issue because it is important to the preservation of resorts, and we want to acknowledge, the CMR wants to acknowledge all the help that that they bring to the table. And Mr. Hammer, thank you for being here. We appreciate it very much. I also want you to know on behalf of the CMR that these jackets are hot. And what a group of dedicated people that would come and walk around the Capitol to promote their issue and their industry that would wear these all day. And I think they deserve a lot of applause and thanks for doing that. Would want to, before I talk about a couple tax issues, also wanted to just let the committee know that Mr. Edmund touched on it, but there is a group that's looking at shoreline management issues that is part of that issue of defining a resort, and we are part of that group with the DNR that is looking at shoreline management issues, and where we hope to get at some point is a statewide policy relative to zoning so that resorts are able to grow and rebuild if there's some type of natural disaster. Last year, this legislature passed a law that authorized or required counties to re-permit facilities that were damaged by natural or other perils. And we're included in that. We understand that that there may be an effort to remove from that requirement any issue related to shoreland, so that if your building blows down in downtown Perham, they have to give you a permit to rebuild it, but if the resort burns down, they wouldn't have to. And we think that's unfair, and that's one of the issues that we're going to be keeping our eye on as the session progresses. Mr. Chairman, in the last couple of years, you have introduced a bill that deals with how the assessor values resorts. And one of the problems that a number of resorts experience is the rising property values of residential lakeshore. And I don't blame the assessor. They've got a job to do, and the law requires them to put the resort on at the estimated market value. What we've asked and what is contained in House File 794 is that the legislature authorize the assessor to use an alternative valuation method where they wouldn't have to simply go by the estimated market value of the property, that they could use the business value of the property or some other method of the approved methods of valuation. We do this currently right now with agricultural property, principally in the metropolitan area where you're operating a farm in Brooklyn Park, which is very valuable commercial real estate. For years, the legislature has authorized what is called a Green Acres process where the assessor essentially keeps two sets of books. We keep the value of that farm if you keep on farming it, and then we keep the estimated market value of what it's worth in the property. If you convert that value of the farm to commercial use, the person that converts that use has to go back and pay the tax that's been held in abeyance during that period of time, and they reach back anywhere from 3 to 5 years. We have your bill, Chairman Housen, a number of you are co-authors of that, would allow a similar process for resort properties so that the assessor can look at the value, the going concern value of your resort. And we think that that will help preserve resort properties and possibly eliminate some of the incentive to have to sell your resort for other residential development. We also, Mr. Chairman, are supportive of a bill that was introduced in the Senate. I think it'll be numbered in the House on Thursday, Senate File 779, and that increases the first tier for 1C resort properties from 500 to 600,000, and then drops the class rate from 1% down to 0.55. We think, again, that's a step in the right direction. It gets at this problem of the rising value. You've done that with farm property, and it is analogous, and we think that certainly has merit, and we are more than happy to support that. Representative Simpson has a bill that allows resort properties to be included in the limited market value assessment like other residential homesteads. And I know that as that bill comes forward, we're interested in working with him both for what year they would set the limited market value at. I think it was at 2001 last year in your legislation. And where that is set is important to us. And how long that program continues is important to us as well. And we certainly encourage that that effort. And the last bill that we had talked to this committee or to other tax committees about and would like to help get your support on is a bill that seems so simple to me that I'm almost embarrassed that I can't push this one across the goal line. But we would like to change the first half property payment date for resort properties, 1C resort properties, from May 15th until June 30th. And what that does is it allows these seasonal businesses to get their business up and running around Mother's Day, around the opening of fishing, get their cash flow going, and pay that first half payment at a time when their business is operating. It's simply a cash flow issue. We had set that bill at July 15th at one point, and we moved it back to the 30th of June. Many counties are doing that already, and we think a uniform provision is certainly appropriate. The reason we changed it is that on July 1st, the counties have to pay out to school districts, townships, watershed districts, and all the other local units of government that they have to settle up with. And so they want to get that money in before their settlement date with the local governments. But beyond that, we don't think there's any impact to anyone, and it's simply just matching up a government-imposed payment with your business cycle. Currently, second half farm property taxes are due not on October 15th like everyone else. They're due on November 15th because it allows you to get the harvest in and get your farm product to market and then pay your tax bill. This is just analogous to that, and we are encouraging adoption of that as well. So, Mr. Chairman and members, we appreciate the time that you give to this issue. We're here not to ask you to make the sunshine or the snowfall or the fish bite. We're trying to get you to focus on issues that the government can actually control and imposes on these businesses, and we appreciate the time and the effort that you spend dealing with small resorts and tourism in general. Be happy to answer any questions, and thank you for having us here.
Representative Simpson.
Just a comment. I'd like to thank Mr. Carlson and all you folks for taking time to come down here today. This is a statewide issue, and you people are all taxpayers. You all create jobs, and you all stimulate the economy of Minnesota. I happen to own a retail grocery store in a community that's affected by tourism. And when you talk about the pre-Labor Day start, I understand that. I see what happens on Main Street when the cars disappear. So it is a statewide issue, and I think if we work together, we can make this thing happen. And I'm very appreciative of the fact that the chairman has brought this thing forward to the table. So thank you.
Representative Moore.
Quick question, Mr. Chairman. You said that you've tried to move this bill before, not paying taxes, property or resort taxes until the 30th, but you said it was stalled before. You had a challenge with it before. What's been the roadblock? It seems to be pretty common sense to me.
Mr. Carlson.
I would say, Mr. Chairman and Representative Moe, issues unrelated to us. When they don't have a tax bill and you're in the tax bill for whatever reason, you don't succeed. And so I don't believe that it is significantly related to our issue. In 2003 and 2004, we never really got a good whack at this issue in a tax conference committee. We're hoping for a better result this year.
Mr. Carlson, when was the last time we had a tax bill?
It's been a while, and we see 10 to 15 resorts a month that get sold. So the longer we wait, the worse the problem's going to be. And so we need you to do everything you can to help this along.
But Mr. Carlson, you mentioned about this subject of the delay in the property tax. You said some counties are going along with this. Do the counties have the authority to wait without penalty?
Mr. Chairman, maybe Mr. Kuha or Karen Baker would be better. There, I believe, is some provision for a grace period in the payment of your taxes without penalties and interest being assessed.
I'm getting one of these from.
Yeah. How aggressively that's enforced, I don't know. But I do know that I've heard from some of our members that they haven't had a particular issue with their assessor if their bill comes in closer to the 15th.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Members, have any more questions? Or?
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Thank you all for coming.
Thanks for coming today. It's great to have you. Meeting's adjourned.